KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Falls Pass.
Welcome to Native America Calling, I'm Sean Spruce. In a move not seen in 60 years, President Donald Trump is using National Guard troops and U.S. Marines in response to protests in Los Angeles. The governor and local officials say the military response is against their wishes and only fans the flames of conflict. We'll discuss what the president's use of emergency powers to use military force against protesters means for the future of direct action as a means of raising public awareness of Native issues. That's coming up right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull. Last Friday, a federal judge in Phoenix denied a pair of motions seeking preliminary injunction to stop the Oak Flat land swap between the U.S. Forest Service and multinational mining company Resolution Copper. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has details.
Federal Judge Dominic Lanza considered their pleas premature amid a nearly two-hour hearing at the Sandra Day O'Connor Courthouse. In fact, Lanza had admittedly made up his mind before plaintiffs, including the San Carlos Apache Tribe and a coalition of conservation and recreation groups, showed up in court. The judge said granting their request would subvert an act of Congress. However, Lanza also ruled that the Forest Service could not proceed with the land exchange until the 60-day mark following the government public publishing its final environmental impact statement for the proposed copper mining project. The federal agency is expected to release that report later this month. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Roughly 73 square miles of forest land in Northern California have been returned to the Yurok tribe in what's being called the largest land back conservation project in state history. Christina Onnested reports.
The land back more than doubles the Yurok tribe's ancestral land holdings, including salmon habitat and areas of cultural and spiritual significance. Tiana Williams-Clausen is the Yurok tribe's wildlife department director.
Reacquiring landscapes like this allows us to heal, to work towards healing a wound that was inflicted not only on the lands but our hearts when these lands were taken away from us.
Josh King of Western Rivers Conservancy says his organization bought and transferred the land to the tribe in phases, raising $56 million for the conservation deal.
We're thrilled to announce that we've transferred the final phase of land to the Yurok tribe and completed creation of the Blue Creek Salmon Sanctuary and the Yurok Tribal Community Forest.
Historically, the Yurok tribe had fished, hunted, and gathered here. The tribe lost 90% of its territory through gold rush massacres and disease from settlers. Timber companies owned and managed the land for over a century. Tim Hayden is the Yurok tribe's deputy executive director of natural resources.
This is an incredible opportunity for the tribe to really assert its self-determination, manage its own resources for the benefit of both fish and wildlife, provide access for ceremonial and subsistence and gathering needs of the tribe.
Salmon and trout populations were once the third largest in the Klamath. Now with the dam removal complete, there's hope those populations will rebound. Pergish Carlson is a river guide with the Yurok.
Generations from here will really see the benefits of it, even when I'm gone or whatever. And that's what I always kind of like smile about the future generations, how good it could be even from now.
I'm Christina Onnested, reporting for National Native News in Northern California.
And on this day in 1971, federal officers removed the last few Native activists from Alcatraz. Launched November 20, 1969, the occupation of Alcatraz Island was carried out by the group Indians of All Tribes. They claimed Alcatraz was rightfully theirs through the 1868 Treaty of Fort Laramie, and by the federal government's closing of the prison island in 1963, designating it surplus federal property. At its peak, the occupation saw roughly 400 Natives and allies. Celebrities like Jane Fonda, Marlon Brando, and Jonathan Winters all visited. In the final months, power and telephone services were cut off, and a young girl fell to her death, devastating her parents and causing them to leave. Despite setbacks, many see this occupation as the launchpad of modern American Indian activism. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios of Eugene, Oregon.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
DT Track, your healthcare partner across Indian country, supports this show. DT Track provides culturally competent nationwide healthcare staffing to IHS, tribal, and urban health facilities. More at dt-track.com. Support by Siri, with a diverse and strategic investment portfolio for the long-term benefit of their shareholders. Investing in energy, infrastructure, real estate, government services, and more. Information is available at ciri.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. In addition to high-profile confrontations over immigration in Los Angeles, protests are popping up in a handful of other cities. A number of other rallies are planned for this weekend. President Donald Trump called in the National Guard and the Marines to Los Angeles to support immigration raids, prompting concerns by local and state officials that their presence will only heighten the potential for violent clashes. The use of the military to confront protesters is the latest in a series of measures to counter public protests since the high-profile protests at Standing Rock and following the death of George Floyd. At the same time, there are increasing incidents of untrained, armed individuals showing up at protests in an apparent attempt to act as self-appointed security. Today we'll hear from organizers about the new reality for direct action. Of course, you can join our conversation too. Do current events in Los Angeles make you think differently about your right to protest? Let us know. Give us a call, 1-800-996-2848, 1-800-996-2848, or just 1-800-99-NATIVE. We have the phone lines open now. Joining us from Los Angeles, California, is Joel Garcia. He's an artist and cultural organizer and director of Mesley Projects. He is of Wishol descent. Good morning, Joel. Welcome to Native America Calling.
Good morning. Good morning, everybody out there.
Joining us from Lawrence, Kansas, is Dr. Robert Warrior. He's the Hall Distinguished Professor of American Literature and Culture at the University of Kansas. He's also a former appointed chair of the Osage Nation Editorial Board. He is Osage. Robert, hello and welcome back to you. Good to have you on the show again.
Hey, thanks, Sean. Good to be here.
And our third guest joins us from Spokane, Washington, Jacob Johns. He is the executive director of a Wisdom Keepers delegation. He is Hopi and Akamal Otham. Jacob, good morning and welcome to you as well. Pleasure to have you on the show.
Hey, it's good, Tosh. It's good to be here.
You bet. Well, I want to begin with Joel in Los Angeles. And Joel, a lot of headlines there in LA because of these clashes between protesters, law enforcement officials. What can you tell us about what you've seen personally?
First of all, what's being shown online is a very small fraction of like everything that's going on. There have also been a lot of gatherings that have not involved law enforcement, have not involved clashes. For example, yesterday evening, in front of City Hall, there was an interfaith gathering. There's also a lot of organizing happening in communities with community members who are developing different forms of alertness around where ICE is situated, where they're targeting community members. And, you know, so there's a lot of activity that's taking shape. A lot of organizing, a lot of mutual aid support that is not being also like shown in the media. And of course, it's not going to be shown in the media, but the majority of that is happening.
Well, tell us more about your role in the protests and why it was important for you to get involved.
I'm born and raised here in East Los Angeles. My family has been impacted by these measures. For example, my grandmother, a Native woman, her family was deported during the Mexican Repatriation Act of the 1930s. So as a, you know, as a, I believe she was somewhere like 7, 8 years old, was deported to Mexico to a place that she had never been to, didn't know, and whatnot, right? And that process was a process of stripping people of their identity and giving them a new identity in Mexico. Much of that is happening again. It has continued over and over. There was Operation Wetback and whatnot. So I come from a family that's been directly impacted by these issues, even though, you know, we are Native Indigenous folks. Los Angeles, specifically East LA, has a history of organizing, you know, from the implementation of the mission system, right? We had Soy Purina, a Tongva woman who organized against, you know, forced conversion and the mission system. In much more recent times, this is also the area where the East LA walkouts have been pushing for the, you know, desegregation of schools here in Los Angeles. You also had the Chicano Moratorium, which was organizing against the Vietnam War. So there's a big legacy of organizing just here in East Los Angeles, you know, period. As an artist, as a young person in high school, I was politicized by what was happening at the time, which was the criminalizing of youth through various propositions, state propositions and bills to, you know, treat teenagers as adults when they get arrested. There was a three strikes law, and so on. So in some way, it's kind of unavoidable, which is horrible. But also as an artist, I think this place has had a huge legacy in using arts and culture to combat racism, this type of hate that we're seeing now, and, you know, administrations like the Trump administration. So there, you know, to some extent, there is no workaround. Like, you get involved and you find ways to do that.
Mm-hmm. Joel, coming on our show today, a live, nationally syndicated radio show and podcast, do you have any concerns about discussing actions that you're taking during the protests publicly?
No. We're targeted already. You know, there's, you know, in many ways, the way, like, our communities are spoken about, they're spoken about as, you know, underserved communities, or, you know, that's kind of the tone. But we know that these communities are targeted. We know that they're disinvested in intentionally. You know, we're artists here. We do a lot of artistic work. But our work is also very much connected to policy changes. Like, you know, some of the things that we did in 2020 was participate heavily in the removal of hateful monuments here in Los Angeles. Part of being an artist and being organized is also knowing how the law functions, what it's meant to do, you know, because the law can be written in a certain way, but it's not meant to do that exact thing. It's implemented in a whole different way. So as creatives, we can see, you know, we can see gaps in these laws and these ordinances, and that has been a way for us to be able to, you know, in some way hack what it currently is here in order to be able to organize and mobilize and, you know, create policy changes, which have happened. You know, much of the apologies that elected officials have offered to Native communities here, especially First Peoples, have been because of some of this work that, you know, arts and culture has been able to drive.
Joel, we talked earlier about what a lot of folks are seeing on television, National Guardsmen, Marines. What can you tell us? What have you seen with regard to the National Guard and the Marines? And does that concern you, their presence right now?
Well, I want to get a little bit further back. So the National Guard has also been here because of the fires. So there's already been, you know, presence of the National Guard in various stages of the county.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The National Guard has been brought here to Los Angeles during the, you know, the Watch Riots, or the Watch Uprising, I mean, the South Central, the 92 Uprising, you know, and so it's concerning that, yeah, a militarized presence is here. But I think for folks listening out there, at one point, the Sheriff's Department here in East LA was one of the most heavily armed forces in the entire planet. So that's the level of, like, militancy that we've, you know, folks here in East LA and LA have had to live with. So is it a concern? Yes. Is it very different from much of what we've seen in the past 20, 30, 40, 50 years? No. And then there's also, I guess, you know, kind of from what we've seen, some understanding of the role of the National Guard. Like, the National Guard is not out in the streets patrolling like the Los Angeles Police Department or the sheriffs are. They're stationed at the federal buildings. And, you know, that yesterday we saw a couple of National Guard stationed in different parts of East LA as certain, you know, attempted raids were happening by ICE at a food processing plant down the street, at a elementary school that were driving around. So they're there to, I don't know, intimidate, you know. From what we understand, they're not allowed to have live munitions on their person out there. But again, we can never trust that, you know, they're going to follow the own laws that, you know, their own laws that they always break. So mm-hmm. it's a concern, but we also kind of moving with, you know, with a sense of like unfortunately we've seen this before, we've had to deal with this before, and we also work to figure out how to work around this situation.
All right. The governor of California and local officials have said that the president's strategy is to actually provoke confrontations to warrant a more severe crackdown, as an example, for any other similar protests elsewhere. Listening to you describe the history of law enforcement presence there, or military or National Guard presence, I'm curious to know, does that argument carry weight with you?
Yes, absolutely. Going back to the early 2000s, there was the Democratic National Convention that happened in downtown LA where, you know, the police was first being militarized, like definitely attacked folks who were, you know, staging an action there. There was a concert, there was a lot of youth, and, you know, police went in there and, you know, hurt people. And that was, you know, we've seen agitators at these marches before. We've seen agitators at these gatherings before. And so there's, you know, that is highly probable that their intention is to push it to a place where they can totally squash any sort of, you know, counter thought or dissent from white supremacy, you know, point blank. Mm-hmm.
All right. Joel Garcia kicking off our conversation here on Native America Calling. He is in Los Angeles, where he's an artist, cultural organizer, and a director of Messley Projects. And he's explaining what he's seen with regard to the protests there in Los Angeles. He's bringing us up to date. We've got the phone lines open. If you're listening to the show right now, maybe you are in the Los Angeles area and you have some experiences or some insights to share. We'd like to hear from you. 1-800-996-2848. 1-800-996-2848. We're going to come back and continue this conversation. Cities are moving to clear out long-standing homeless encampments after a Supreme Court decision clears the way for enforcement actions against makeshift shelters. We'll look at options for unsheltered relatives and for cities confronting difficult decisions about safety and housing. That's on the next Native America Calling.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
So now you see the light. We got to stand up for your rights. Get up and stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up and stand up.
Come on.
Don't give up the fight.
Come on, y'all.
Get up and stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up and stand up.
Get up.
Don't give up.
You're listening to Native America Calling. We're talking about increasingly strict crackdowns on public protests. Officials in Los Angeles are concerned about the heightened potential for violent clashes under President Trump deployed National Guard and Marines to support immigration efforts in that city. Are tougher actions needed in light of the destruction and violence in places like Standing Rock in Minneapolis? Tell us what you think. 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. We've already got our first caller of the day on the line. This is Shannon, who is in Los Angeles, where he's listening online. Good morning, Shannon. How you doing?
Good morning, sir. How you guys doing over there? Shannon Rivers. Thank you so much for having me on the call.
Absolutely. Well, tell us what's going on. What are you seeing?
So I'll give you a little bit of background of who we are first. We're the California Native Vote Project. Our mission is to achieve justice and self-determination through Native American communities, through multi-generational power building, organizing, and civil engagement. We are co-partners with CHIRLA, which is the immigrants' rights organization, human rights organization here in LA.
Okay.
For indigenous communities. And then finally with Cielo, which is a indigenous community organization here in Los Angeles County. And just to give you some numbers, brother, is that we're about 300,000 Native Americans living in Los Angeles County. We are, there are about 1 million Zopatec, Mixtec indigenous peoples that call Los Angeles County their home. So I wanted to give you those numbers. Last night, I was at the prayer vigil in downtown Los Angeles near the City Hall. We had several thousand people coming together. We had the Mayor Bass of Los Angeles County showed up and to give a welcoming to the prayer vigil, those in attendance. We had thousands of police in the street, L.A. County. And LA Sheriff's Department, LA Police Department. We also had the National Guard guarding the federal buildings in downtown. But what we saw primarily last night was a peaceful prayer vigil with thousands of spiritual leaders, hundreds of people, thousands of people gathering in the streets of downtown LA. And I think I want to dispel some of the myths that there's a lot of rioting going on. There's not. Last night there was a curfew at 8 o'clock, put on by the Governor Newsom and Mayor Bass. But the majority, about 90% of the people left. There were some people that stayed around that stayed past the curfew, and there was some small clashes back and forth. Do we think that the National Guard and the military needs to show up? No. These are false accusations by the current administration. We saw the power and the strength and the displacement of people at Standing Rock, which I was at. We constantly see this aggression going on. And I think what's happening, even to our Native folks throughout Indian country, I want them to understand that we are supportive of our brothers and sisters who come in from the South, but indigenous peoples from all over the world that call Los Angeles their home. We are a melting pot, if you will, of this country, and Los Angeles has the largest immigrant population, I think, in the country. So we want to make sure that the folks that are listening to your show, our Native folks in the community, our Native folks on the res. I myself am from Gila River Indian Community in Arizona. I live and work here in Los Angeles. I've been here for a while, got my master's at UCLA.
All right, okay.
We've done a lot of great things here in the community, and we're showing our support with the community members of LA and the indigenous community members of LA. So,
Shannon, thank you. Really appreciate you calling in from Los Angeles and sharing these insights. Really valuable to hear from you. Thank you again. Let's bring Dr. Robert Warrior into our conversation now in Lawrence, Kansas. And Robert, let's talk more about the National Guard. It's been called in before to quell protests. What's different about what's happening now there in Los Angeles?
So one of the things that's different, Sean, and thanks for covering this issue. These issues are they're obviously very complex, but I think right away on the National Guard, first of all, there's been you know, the governor of California wasn't involved or didn't actually call for the California National Guard to be called into Los Angeles. So the executive branch went straight over the head of the governor. And that's the general pathway that, you know, that things follow, is that the governor calls in the National Guard. Obviously, that's something that makes this unusual. And then after that, of course, you have the 700 Marines who are called in as well. And that's a, you know, that's a that puts me in the mindset of the Wounded Knee takeover in 1973, when basically U.S. forces were brought in to that conflict. And and that really raises the stakes on things. I mean, these were obviously people who were Wounded Knee people in 1973, were many of them were Oglala people from Pine Ridge, and many of them were Native people from across the United States who were part of the American Indian Movement, who were in solidarity with those people at Pine Ridge. But they were also Americans. They were American citizens, many of them. And so that's a really stark move to call in the military against your own people.
Let's talk about protests when they do turn into destructive riots that can result in widespread damage to businesses and property. There are images online of burned out Waymo cars that have been destroyed during what's happening there in Los Angeles. Do protests accomplish what they set out to do when they turn into situations like that? What's your thought?
Really, really great question. So I wrote a book with Paul Chott Smith called Like a Hurricane that chronicles a lot of what happened between Alcatraz, which I heard that anniversary today. I hadn't even thought about that, about the last people being taken off of Alcatraz and that between then and Wounded Knee in 1973. So I write a book like that, and one of the questions you always get is, was it worth it? Did people achieve their goals? And I think oftentimes you can look at it and say, what was their goal? No, they did not achieve it. There was not a cultural center built on Alcatraz or a university or the other things that people wanted. That doesn't mean, though, that things aren't accomplished and that things don't happen because of the dynamics that are involved. I think that to me, as a scholar, but also as somebody very interested in what it means to be a Native person, to be a citizen of a Native nation who lives in the United States, I think that it's really important to understand the way that things boil over when there's pressure there's pressure applied in certain situations, and these things don't come from nowhere. I also think it's really important to listen to Joel and also to Shannon. Those are people on the ground who are telling us what you're seeing is not really the story. It's a different sort of story that's going on. You are seeing isolated incidents, but it's still contained within a fairly small area. The things that you're hearing out of Washington are clearly made up about the extent of these protests. So I think that it's just important to say, listen really carefully to what you hear, and does it match up with what you can even look at on the coverage, just, you know, that critical coverage, especially of independent sorts of sources. But I think that listening really carefully is really important to say, does this match up with the things I'm seeing in front of me? Does a burned car, or even four burned cars, does that mean that the whole city is under siege, as we're being told? And I think that that's an important thing. And all of us are familiar with that, I think, from being in the Native world. We are reported on all the time. And we're either protesting or we're at a powwow, you know, and all of us know that the Native world is so much more complicated than that. The day to day that goes on is a much more complex world.
Mm-hmm. Robert, I remember having a conversation with someone about 15 years ago. It was when social media was really taking hold. And this person said, the days of old school in-person protests, they're over. It's all social media. It's all the digital age. And then Standing Rock came along, and then George Floyd, and now what we're seeing. And it amazes me that even with all the technology, even with all of the digital capability, sometimes people just like to get out there and hit the streets. They like to hit the dirt, and they like to get out there and just be seen and be visible. But I'm curious to know your thoughts, because do you have any insights into what kinds of protests here today in 2020 are most effective? Is it in-person stuff like what we're seeing there in Los Angeles, or is it using online strategies, or is it a combination of both? What's really working these days?
So I think, again, I would go towards the corollaries to the protests, not always just the immediacy that's there, but that thing that pulls people into that moment of protest. When I always say what people usually relate to in these discussions is when did you cross the line? And you say, when did I cross the line from being mad to being actually protesting? Did I join something? I was there watching a march and I said, I'm just going to join these folks. I'm stepping over that line from being a spectator to being someone who's part of something. It may just be a little part of it, but I'm a part of it. So, but saying that, I think that one of the benefits of that, and one of the things I'm really glad that the person you talked to, I think is wrong, that mm-hmm. online protests are really important. Oftentimes they call people to together. But one of the things that I think is really important, and this is especially true, I think you already hear it in what Joel said and what Shannon has said, is these are the things that actually allow us to relate to other Indigenous people we've never even met, you know. And I think that we get to see if you hang out for a while with people who are from communities and people who have migrated to the United States, if they're Zapotec or Mixtec or the Mayan people from Central America or even people from South America, that they've come here because of economic pressures. Some of them come here not speaking Spanish, and people expect them to speak Spanish, and including the authorities, but including us too, as people who live in the United States and are from Native nations in the U.S. But we really have to see then the erasure that has occurred that impacts us as Native people. And I think that's one of the real benefits. Spend some time with people from those communities, and you'll start to see, well, these places are not that much different. I mean, there can always be these huge differences, just like there's huge differences between, you know, Hopi people and Osage people, right? And Cherokee people and Hopi people and all those sorts of things. But I think that's one of the things that you get that's harder to get online. You get a little bit of it, but, you know, being in those situations where you're really having to spend time and see somebody, you know, to really see them. I think that's one of the really important things. And to share, I think back to Alcatraz, how much the students who were there, that was one of the things that I heard from so many people I talked to who were at Alcatraz in 1969, 1970, and 1971, is that they just learned from each other and they spent time with each other, and they had a deeper knowledge of the Native world through spending time with each other.
Robert, you were involved in a conflict over press coverage of Osage tribal government. Tell us more about that. What was at stake during that dispute? And do you see any principles that might inform what's going on in Los Angeles now?
Yeah, thanks for asking that, Sean, because I think one of the things that we really need to keep in mind is that the freedoms we're talking about, the freedom to express yourself, the freedom to assemble, that people are relying on when they go to a protest, whether it's in Los Angeles or Chicago or, you know, here in Lawrence, Kansas, where people sometimes march and often do march, and have these sorts of things, that that those are very closely related to the freedoms that many of our tribal nations, including the Osages, have adopted towards freedom of the press. That's what people are fighting for when they are Native journalists, usually, is the freedom, even if they're funded by tribal government. Then they are still looking for that freedom to be able to cover stories and tell the honest story from their point of view as journalists, to do their job professionally. So my job when I was the chair of the Osage Nation editorial board, along with my two colleagues on that, who were both much better and much more accomplished journalists than I was, we were responsible for standing between the tribal government and the paper, the Osage News, which is really a media. I mean, Osage Media that the Osage News produces, whether in print or online. And we saw the beginnings of what became a very difficult situation where we had a tribal government, where we had elected tribal leaders who were involved in things that ended up being those leaders, that one leader especially was had to step down. And mm-hmm. We had a pretty new government at that point, and it was a very difficult situation. But I was just so amazed at the way that both that the editorial board, after I was not on it anymore, how they really had to navigate these sorts of issues from within a Native community, and that how especially though the staff of the Osage News covered in an honest way really difficult issues about corruption. Where did this money go and why did it go there? And when I was the chair, I got calls from our chief saying, he was concerned about the coverage. He wanted it to stop. He was tired of, wanted the paper to stop publishing stories about these issues. And, being the chair of the shield, we were the shield, and we really had to stand together as a board and say, this is our job. We are protecting this precious freedom we have chosen for ourselves. Seeing the aftermath of that, I think that we've become a better and stronger people because we have a free press, and because we have seen the impact of that in making our government better, more honest, and more accountable.
Thanks, Robert. We're going to take another break. We're going to come back and we'll be talking with Jacob Johns. He's the executive director of a Wisdom Keepers delegation. He's in Spokane, Washington. And we still have the phone lines open for listeners who'd like to join the conversation also. That number is 1-800-996-2848. 1-800-99-NATIVE.
Support by the American Indian College Fund, providing millions of dollars of scholarships to Native students every year. Applications are accepted through May 31st at collegefund.org or by phone at 800-766-FUND.
Support by AARP. AARP creates and connects people to unique tools and programs, helps conserve personal resources, and tackles issues that matter most to individuals, families, and communities. More at AARP.org.
There are more than 120 Alaskans awaiting a life-saving organ transplant. You can save up to 8 lives and make a difference in your community as an organ donor. It's important to get informed, register, and let your loved ones know your decision. Learn more from Life Center Northwest, the organ procurement organization that stewards the gift of life for all of Alaska, at lcnw.org. That's lcnw.org. Global business executives, top government officials, diplomats, and indigenous leaders will attend Arctic Encounter 2025, North America's premier Arctic policy and business event. From July 30th to August 1st in Anchorage, Alaska, this international summit convenes voices from across the Arctic and beyond to shape policy, investment, and innovation in the far north. Arctic Encounter is where global decisions meet northern realities. Early bird registration closes June 15th at arcticencounter.com, who supports this show.
Support by AARP. AARP creates and connects people to unique tools and programs, helps conserve personal resources, and tackles issues that matter most to individuals, families, and communities. More at AARP.org.
Support by Costco Business Center, offering delivery to Anchorage Air Cargo Companies for shipments to rural Alaska, for business and home. More at CostcoBusinessDelivery.com.
This is Native America Calling. Public protests have been a means of raising awareness for indigenous issues for decades. Official and unofficial counter-protest actions are increasing, prompting organizers to change strategies. What protest actions or tactics are most effective in your view? Is destruction of property ever justified? There's still time to join this conversation. Just call us at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Let's now talk with Jacob Johns, joining us from Spokane, Washington, the executive director of a Wisdom Keepers delegation. He's Hopi and Akamal Atham. And Jacob, good morning again. Thank you so much for joining the show. You are an active organizer, but 2 years ago, you were actually shot by someone who brought a gun to a rally in northern New Mexico, that person seemingly intent on antagonizing people. Tell us more about that and how, whether or not that changed your approach to public rallies and your role as an as an organizer and an advocate.
Yeah, I mean, my name is Jacob Johns. I'm a community support organizer that has been working on intersectional issues for the past 9 years. I also do the executive director of the Wisdom Keepers delegation, which is one of the projects that I lead, where we advocate with a collective of indigenous wisdom keepers from around the world to co-create and advance contemporary climate policy underneath the UNFCCC. I was actually in New Mexico for a U.S. Climate Action Network covering of the West Coast, and some of the local amazing organizers in the area asked me to come and join a prayer vigil. During the 2020 George Floyd uprisings, the people in the government in the local area decided to take down a statue of a conquistador that they had erected in the 90s that basically glorified the genocide of the first people of that land. And during the 2020 George Floyd uprising, they had foresight to take it down and remove it. And in doing so, you know, there was some public outcry from the from some right-leaning MAGA people. And when we went to the prayer vigil, the county commissioner had decided to go behind closed doors and hire somebody to re-erect the statue and take $100,000 of public funds to re-erect the statue. The local community organizers asked me to come out, and you know, as a Pueblo people, we stand in solidarity with each other. We always have since the 1680, and you know, it's important for us when we get into these places to really stand up and be a voice for history. You know, we can't right the wrongs of the history, but we can correct the mistakes of our past, and this is a step forward for us. You know, and I think especially as indigenous people, just us being here in this country is an act of resistance. You know, people always say, oh, well, you're a world famous activist and you do all these things. But in actuality, you know, it just being in existence in this country makes me a rebel, you know, and that itself is something that's crazy. But even there, as the right wing fascist showed up with a gun and tried to charge into the safe space that we had created for the women and children who were there, he pulled out a gun and shot me in the chest. And you know, when you get shot in the chest with a hollow point bullet, it just destroys your insides. And you know, I ended up dying in the hospital, and you know, had to beg these spirits to let me come back into this body so I can continue to do this work. And when you're met with death in that way, and you think about life as being something that has already been done and begging to come back in, it really gives you a sense of confidence that the spirits and the spirits on the other side have already decided what destiny will be and is waiting for us to realize what that is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the more that we stand in solidarity with each other, the more that we can really create that future that the world so desperately needs And, you know, as indigenous people gathered in New Mexico and in other places, we always have support. We always have support from our allies, and our allies are always within the Hispanic community and immigrant communities. And it's really important for us now to really step up and be the voice for reason, especially as people from foreign countries come here to try to expel other people from foreign countries.
Well, Jacob, tell us more about that support. And you just used the term a sense of confidence. This whole experience gave you this new sense of confidence, or renewed or enhanced sense of confidence. Because surely after having experienced something as horrific as what you went through, I mean, are you more cautious when you go to events, or do you take more precaution, or do you have other people there involved who could potentially step in or intercept somebody who has bad intentions like this individual apparently had 2 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of ongoing, you know, trauma from what took place. And, you know, there's always been evil in the world, you know, and the people have always struggled to live in peace and in harmony. And sometimes we have to stand up, and we have to, you know, take a bullet for the people. And that's a real thing, you know, and people talk about it conceptually as this abstract thought that we have to stand up for our children. We have to stand up for our women. We have to be these warriors that the fractured noise of the world is forcing us to be. And, you know, with that knowledge, it's like when you go out into public, especially in the times presently where we have fascists running the country and doing awful things to society members, you know, I think it's really important for us to realize that just because somebody says that they are in charge doesn't necessarily mean that they are. And we're starting to see that within the streets. When we stand in solidarity together as society, as logical people who understand that we are evolving as human beings, then we understand that we have a future that is shared, and that we have to articulate that future that we're trying to create with each other. You know, people talk about this future, but in real time, we have to discuss what solidarity looks like. And sometimes solidarity looks like taking a bullet. And sometimes solidarity looks like bringing water to a protest to give to people. Sometimes solidarity just means standing in line with your sisters and your brothers from other countries who are just fighting to survive. And that solidarity is important, I think, for all of us. You know, one of my tribes, the Akumaratam, you know, that we have, our Autumn people go all the way from Phoenix all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico. And this was before these imaginary borders came across and separated us from Mexico and from the United States, and all these colonizers created these things. We understand that the Autumn people are still here, and we have our boundaries go past these imagined colonial lines. And so if our genetic sisters and our genetic brothers in North and South America need our help, then we must stand up for each other. We must stand up for each other and echo the voices of logic and reason for a future that's healthy and just and livable. One of the main things that I just signed on to be an executive director for a Wisdom Keepers delegation is that, you know, that we as indigenous people here in North America don't see our connections with our siblings around the world. And that as American citizens, we have the right to speak up. You know, this is why we have the freedom that we have, because we are able to go into these spaces and speak truth to power.
Okay.
And, you know,
okay.
that idea is...
Jacob, I'm sorry. Let me ask you this. You've lived it. You've seen it from every angle at this point. Is there ever justification for violence or destruction at a protest, in your view?
I mean, from the police do it all the time. I mean, is that what you're asking? Because law enforcement 100% destroys property and injures people all over the
time. For many parties, like justified. We're, you know, even protesters though, when things get out of hand and buildings get burned, either side, is there ever any justification?
It's nonviolence that wins. You know, as we look at these attempts at authoritarian powers in the past, it's nonviolence that always wins. You know, they can shoot us, and they can beat us, and they can hurt us, and they can do all of these things, but we still remain. And it's important for us to remember that we have a chance right now to link arms and stand in solidarity with each other, with this idea, you know, that we have each other, and we're not separate from this. And you know, when we have folks that are being violent and being aggressive, We must stand and say, no, this is not us. We are not this. We are the other thing. And, you know, I don't ever suggest being violent. I never, ever suggest destroying property. But I think that it's important for us to realize that the times that we are in right now are jeopardizing our future. And it's jeopardizing a lot of people's rights and freedoms that we have held dear for so long.
All right, thank you, Jacob.
That's an important realization.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Joel, I want to go back to you and ask you the same question. Do you ever see a justification for violence or destruction at a protest coming from either side, either viewpoint, either perspective?
Well, let's first define the term violence. You know, at the moment, I'm getting texts from my 12-year-old niece who is going back to her school. They're on a field trip because of ice activity. So the fact that my 12-year-old niece now is doing ice watch, texting me, texting her mom to alert the community that they just spotted ice at a local restaurant, to me, that's a form of violence, right? The terror that communities are experiencing right now is a form of violence. The exploitation of their wages because they don't have the proper quote-unquote documentation to be in this country working is a form of violence. Burning a car, I don't know if that's violent or self-defense. You know, there's vandalism that occurred in Little Tokyo, and I'm really, really bummed about that because the Little Tokyo community has been a huge, huge ally to Native folks, to the migrant community. And that, you know, that sucks, but as a community, we'll also repair those things. Our community will step up and help clean that and help those businesses stay in a community that's, you know, being gentrified at the moment. Gentrification is violence. So to me, like, let's first define that word. And if, you know, I don't know, building buildings destroys the land here. That's violence.
All right.
So, you know, that some buildings and property gets damaged along the way, I mean, it's unfortunate, but let's also talk about what the police are doing, because we saw these Waymos that were on fire, but on the same day, the police fired, flashbang grenades into a crowd. It caught on fire, on, you know, the side of the hill on the freeway caught on fire, and then some cars who were parked along the side of it caught fire. That was a result of the police. Now, is that violent? Is that destruction? Or is that like just an unfortunate consequence of the police doing their job?
All right. Thank you, Joel. I want to bring Robert back into the conversation. We still have a few minutes before we have to wrap up the show. And Robert, listening to Jacob and listening to Joel and throughout this conversation, I mean, the right to assemble, the right to publicly express disagreement with official policies, these are written into the Constitution. But officials, elected officials, they also have a responsibility to protect people and property from angry mobs. And again, you know, this whole idea of defining violence or what that means or what that might look like. But it seems to me that there's this balance here between public expression and public safety. Robert, where is that line? How do we determine where that line is, and how do we go about making sure that that line is maintained?
Let me say, Sean, I mean, I hear both in both Joel and Jacob a tremendous amount of discipline and an ability to both take their anger and their frustration. I admire both of them in the way that they've spoken today, in really trying to refocus us around what's the source of the rage. I keep thinking back to the BIA takeover in 1972, which happened in election week 1972. A lot of people know a little bit about the story, but one of the enduring images for me that I learned about in the research for that was that somebody inside the BIA building in 1972, after it was over, there was all of this. People used filing cabinets to block the doors, and they threw papers out. But one of the things that somebody found was a typewriter, an old-fashioned typewriter, you know, with keys. And every single key and every single letter inside the typewriter was individually taken and twisted and ruining the typewriter. They could have ruined the typewriter with a hammer. But you think about the concentrated rage it takes for somebody to recognize that it's all the typewriters in the world using all the papers that are in that building, that was what their rage was all about, the bureaucracy, the erasure that we experience as Native people here in the U.S. I think that then at the same time, I have to say, you know, that there were years and years and years when people who were trying to do probate and the things that all of us who ever have to access tribal government know is important, people trying to do probate, people trying to get property taken care of, some of that paperwork was in what was destroyed during the BIA takeover. And, I'm not going to say it shouldn't have happened. I want to understand, where did it come from? What are we not understanding about our own world, our own indigenous world, when we see these things, when we see these flashpoints? What can we learn from that moment? I mean, if it was my car that was being burned, of course, I'd probably have a different opinion, but I'd still want to put it in context. With Jacob being able to say he did take a bullet for that. I also want to really quickly say, Sean, that I hope especially people who are not experienced at these sorts of protests, if you go out and join one, please find the people who organized it and try to find out from them what people there are doing to protect themselves, what they're doing about people who are volunteering to be arrested. You might get arrested just because you're there, but a lot of times the people who are going to be arrested are people who've been trained by the organizers to interact with the police in a way that keeps them safe. And so I would just encourage people to do that. These are serious issues. I'm so glad you're covering them. And I think you bring up really valid points about how do we think about our communities and what do we build the future out of? And if we wreck it, what are we doing to our own future? But I still think we need to understand where the rage is coming from.
And with that, we are out of time, so we're going to have to wrap up this conversation. Thank you to our three guests on the show today, Dr. Robert Warrior, Jacob Johns, and Joel Garcia. Please join us again tomorrow as we check on increasing efforts by cities to clear out homeless encampments and what that means for unsheltered relatives. I'm Sean Spruce. Until then, take care and enjoy the rest of your day.
Pepini, guys, don't wait until you have symptoms. Regular checkups may catch health issues early, and conditions like diabetes, heart disease, liver disease, and prostate cancer are more treatable when caught early. Ask your Indian healthcare provider what health checks are recommended for your age and lifestyle. A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Challenges to societal harmony abound. Trauma, depression, addiction. In Native communities, these challenges affect nearly everyone. The Native American Social Work Studies Institute educates social workers for careers to address the needs of Native communities. You can be part of the solution as a peer support worker, community health worker, or a counselor with culturally relevant training from the Native American Social Work Studies Institute. Info at online.nmhu.edu. New Mexico Highlands University supports this show.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Okay.